From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. Each week we take an issue or an idea and we look at it from a multiplicity of perspectives. This week, it's the Do-It-Yourself Show.
So, Steve, have you ever, you know, doing it yourself always seems so inviting to me, like, hey, yeah, I could do that. Have you ever had something, some home improvement project, something you're not trained to do that you took it on and you thought, hey, yeah, I can do this myself?
Well, I'm not immune to the romance of do-it-yourself. Every so often, something will appear in my life, like a broken toilet, for example, like a kitchen, and I'll think, you know, I can do that myself.
I have duct tape.
And usually that's the preface to a huge tragedy and fiasco. The moment when I say, how hard can it be? That's usually the cut line to
right.
Some kind of abysmal romp through despair and confusion.
Right. We talked to journalist and author Jack Hitt about this. In his book, A Bunch of Amateurs, The Search for the American Character, he argues that actually this romance of the amateur is a foundational idea in American society.
We were perceived as sort of amateurs from the very beginning. I mean, the Brits saw us as children. Kind of helpless children that needed to be taken care of. And I mean that literally. Europeans thought of Americans, people who lived on this continent, they thought the swamp air and the strange atmospheres in the New World actually made us weaker and smaller and stupider. This was a scientific fact in the 18th century, okay? And I'm not making that up. Entire books were written about it. If you look at Diderot's Encyclopedia and you look up America, it would talk about how our dogs were skinny and weak, and our women were less fertile, and the men could not produce as many children, and we weren't able to lift, weights as well as Europeans. It was amazing. They thought all of our animals were particularly sort of Darwinianly challenged. You see, for example, they thought that our snakes, they said, were so lazy that they would just lie on the floor of the forest and unhinge their jaws and wait for one of our retarded squirrels to fall in. That's a quote from the science of the day. And there's a famous scene, Jefferson's, Jefferson is the one that always wrote about it, in his diaries, but, it's a dinner where Ben Franklin is at, in Paris with a bunch of Gallic critics, including some of these scientists who had these American theories, and he asked all the Americans at the table to stand up, and as it turned out, you know, they were all 6 feet tall, like Franklin, who was a huge, very built, even as an old man, he was a huge strapping fellow, and, you know, of course, these tiny little Gallic men. Who
so there.
Yeah, so there.
So much,
you know,
for your science.
But the thing is, we saw ourselves that way too. You know, the Constitution is an improvised document. People forget this, but, you know, we had several versions of the Articles of Confederation that just failed, and we were kind of like, okay, whatever. We will just rewrite this thing until we get it right. And so, and Europeans saw that as ridiculous, right? That we just kept, you know, trying out this government idea until we landed on something that sort of worked. But that's the essence of the amateur spirit, is sort of fiddling around, heading off to the edge of what's known, of what's been done, of what's thought, and fooling around at that edge and trying to discover something new. I, in my book, I chronicle the amateur sort of historian who discovered the Viking settlement in Los Amadeaux in Canada, which proved
right.
that before Columbus, there was actually a visitation by the Vikings. So that guy was a lawyer, not an archaeologist, you know, and this was just his passion. He was he's a Northern European. He was completely obsessed with the sagas. He thought that they were historical documents and not just pretty poems. And he was, he looked at the verbiage and tried to figure out sort of exactly where these things might have happened if they were real. And he found it, right? He spent his summers going across the seas looking for these encampments, and he found one. Went into this little town and said, you know, are there any ancient, like, you know, remains of villages? And this guy said, yeah, this is one. We've all been looking at it. We don't know what it is. And he went up there, and it was a longhouse. It was a Viking longhouse, the remains of one, right? And some professional archaeologists came in and dug and found, you know, metal parts that were definitely Northern European extraction, and that's it. So, by the way, when that guy died, his name was Helge Ingstad. In the obituary in the New York Times, you don't know he's an amateur. because he got so many honorary degrees. And by the time he died, he was a great archaeologist. That's how he's that's how he's celebrated. So all of his amateur past is forgotten, and you see this over and over again, right? Thomas Edison, you know, middle school dropout. Guy didn't have a high school diploma, but who even knows that anymore, right? We think of him as in the he's in the pantheon of some of the greatest people ever, right? Steven Jobs, dropout. Bill Gates, dropout. I mean, we forget this. We, you know, Zuckerberg, right? Harvard dropout.
Right.
So, and on we go. And it's one of the real sort of paradoxes of amateurism is that we constantly are convincing ourselves that that was some previous age when it was simpler. Life was simpler. And you could just invent things. And we live in this more complicated time. But of course, you don't have to go back very far to realize that everybody has been saying that since we, you know, sort of emerged from, you know, the jungle.
Let's talk a little bit about the garage, because you really talk about the garage. This is, you call it the outpost of joy, love, and freedom. Tell me about the garage as a place for this amateur revolution.
The garage is really the American temple of ingenuity, right? It's where any man or woman goes to get away from all that is them, right? The house is the ball and chain. The house is the dog. The house is the bills. The house is the kids. The house is the spouse. But the garage is this refuge from all of that. When you go in there, you almost enter this sort of state of play. You know, it's full of tools or whatever it is that you're fooling around with. And you can go in there and sort of just release your mind from all of the daily cares. I think that's one of the reasons why the garage or the basement ends up as this kind of sort of like the sort of paradigmatic locus of American genius, right? By the way, David Packard, just before he died, He and Hewlett had invented a lot of the modern machinery that we all live by today in a garage in Palo Alto. He spent $20 million refurbishing that garage to make it look like the thing that he and Hewlett walked into in the 40s, right, and started inventing the modern world. It's now a National Historic Landmark. You can go by there and take little tours, you know, if you ask nicely. Because, and by the way, the garage in Cupertino, California, where Jobs and Wozniak, you know, put together the first sort of like, you know, desktop computer, you know, that's going to become a museum. I mean, we know that's going to happen. Zuckerberg's dorm room at Harvard will be like, you know, sealed off and you'll take tours. But these garages especially, you know, they're the places where people, I think, can enter into that state of mind that ends up being the most productive. There are all sorts of theorists and academics studying productivity, studying innovation. And one of the things, one of the common denominators of all of that is this sort of the sense of play that's at the very heart of creation, right? This almost a silliness, right? That you're just kind of fooling around. That's why we say, I'm just fiddling around, fooling around, just, you know, because you kind of don't know where you are or where you're going. And that's when creativity can happen.
I'm Mr. Amateur.
That was Jack Hitt, journalist and author of A Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character.
I'm Mr. Amateur with a cupcake.
You know, it's one thing to decide to do something yourself, but beyond the idea of just doing it, there's this whole DIY ethic, this post-punk refusal of expertise in some kind of fundamental way.
Right. When we really see that emerge from punk in the late 70s as a cultural form, as something that really the DIY ethic that people really take as part of their own characters.
Davy Rothbart, the editor of Found magazine and the author of My Heart is an Idiot, in a lot of ways embodies that kind of aesthetic.
So this is a really successful guy. He's got a huge following.
But he started out with just a pair of scissors and a roll of scotch tape.
Found Magazine. Let's start there.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't know how to go about. I've had friends that have launched actual magazines that are successful and still and enduring, and they were better at putting together a business plan, finding investors, doing all that stuff. That's not my skill set. I had the idea of doing Found Magazine from a note that was found on the windshield of my own car.
Right, so tell us how that happened.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I was in Chicago where I used to live and came out to my car late one night, and on my windshield is a note addressed to Mario. So my name's Davey. I'm like, what the heck is this? I read it. It said, Mario, I hate you. You said you had to work. Why is your car here at her place? Oh. You're a liar. I hate you. I hate you. Signed Amber. P.S. Page me later.
I thought. Page me later.
Page me later. Yeah. I mean, she's so angry and upset with him, but still hopeful and in love. And I just thought, you know, this thing's amazing. I started showing it to my friends. And I was amazed how many of them had these great found notes to share with me in return. You know, like a kid's drawing, a to-do list, some journal entry they found on the subway. And I just thought, you know, wouldn't it be great for there to be a magazine where everybody can share what they're finding?
What do you think it is about the found object that is so fascinating?
I mean, to me, it's just these notes, these little scraps of paper, they just give you such a powerful glimpse into other people's lives. And
so that's voyeurism?
Yeah, but I think a certain degree of voyeurism is healthy. You know, it's natural. We're surrounded by strangers all the time, just walking on the street, sitting on the bus. You know, I think it's natural to be curious what other people's experience of being human is like. You know, and that's what these notes give us in this really intense way. And also just the fact that they're written so unselfconsciously. You know, it's a piece of the story. It's up to you to fill in the blanks.
I think that's, for me, that's the fascination of the found object, is the fragmentary nature of it, right? The way that it's not exactly a voyeuristic experience, right? You're not exactly, you know, you're not in the rear window checking it all out, right? You have a piece of something, and that it engages you not so much as an audience, or not only as an audience, but also as a creator.
It sparks your imagination, and it's up to you to figure out what's really going on here. You know, we hunger for what's real, and nothing is more real than these notes that were created without a thought of an audience. You know, they were written, one person writing a love note to someone else, or someone writing in a journal. And so when you, it's just so unfiltered, it's so raw, it's so intimate. And so, you know, you really feel drawn deeply into another person's life, which is, you know, really powerful. For me, you know, having found these notes and started collecting them from friends, I just thought, well, I'll make a zine. And that's the beauty of zine culture, is that, you know, you can, whatever your interest is, you can, you know, I'm not even that good with computers, honestly, and with like Photoshop and PageMaker and stuff. So I just, you know, I literally would tape these found notes to pieces of paper, write a little caption next to it, and who found it and where it was. And, you know, I think after collecting finds for a few months, I had enough to put together the first issue of the magazine. So me and my two cousins, who were like 14 and 19, you know, we spent like three nights just with Scotch tape and scissors putting the first issue of the magazine together. And we went to Kinko's with the idea to make 50 copies, because that's how grand I was thinking. And this punk rock kid was working at Kinko's that night, and he was like, dude, this is awesome. Let's make 800. and I thought that was, you know, what are we going to do with 800, you know? And he was like, no, you know, we'll get them out. You know, I can help you copy them cheap, and I'll help you collate and staple them. So we did that, and we had a release party a week later, and maybe 100 friends came, each bought a copy for $5, which was cool. But that left me with 700 copies filling my apartment in boxes, you know. And, and I was leaving on a trip a few weeks later, and my roommate at the time, Tim, he's a singer in what started as a DIY band, Rise Against, a little punk rock band. Now they're massive, but he was mad because, you know, you couldn't move around the apartment with all these boxes. And when I came back from the trip a few weeks later, you know, I was like, sorry, man, see you. And I got back a few weeks later, and all the boxes were gone. And I thought that either he'd thrown them out or put them in the basement where it always flooded down there. And he said, no, so many people were coming over to get like one copy or three or five copies for their friends. The neighbors called the police. They thought he was selling drugs out of the apartment.
Is that right?
Which was just crazy. But to me, you know, it's just, you know, what it proves to me is, like, if I had spent time trying to put together some business plan and find investors to launch Found Magazine, you know, it's grown since then.
Yeah.
And I no longer, you know, it's still put together with Scotch tape and scissors, but, you know, we print them now at a real printer and stuff. But I think that it would have never happened. I would have never had a magazine. I talk to other people who say, you know, I want to make a movie, but, you know, I can't afford film school, or I can't, you know, I don't have $200,000. And I'm like, you know, the tools are in the hands of the people, you know. The equipment you need to make a full-length movie is like in the, you know, few thousand dollar range, not hundreds of thousands like it used to be.
That was Davey Rothbart, founder and editor of Found Magazine, author of My Heart is an Idiot. This is Off Topic. Stay with us. Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. It's the do-it-yourself episode. And when it comes to things that you can do yourself, there are, I think, three broad types of things. There are things that you can do and therefore should do. There are things that you cannot do and therefore should not do. And there are the things that you might be able to do, but they're illegal. One of the things that's illegal to do yourself, distilling whiskey.
And yet, it's so attractive.
It's a temptation that's out there that it exists, I think, in all of our minds, or the minds maybe of a particular subsection of the population, to think, maybe I could make my own whiskey. Maybe that's a thing that I could attempt. So I talked to Michael Myers. He's the owner of 291 Distillery right here in Colorado Springs. I want to know, how does it happen that you find yourself a whiskey distiller?
I read an article about the guy that created Hendrix Gin and Sailor Jerry Rum, and thought, I can do that. So how I got to that point was I was a fashion and beauty photographer in New York.
Really?
Yep. Lived three blocks from the World Trade Center on 9/11. Went through a crazy day and time with that. Moved to Colorado. I commuted for 3 years almost every week back to New York for photography, and got to a point where I was like, I've got to do something different.
So what was the, walk us through a little bit of the steps of educating yourself in the industry, educating yourself. Had you at least been a whiskey drinker?
Yes.
All right.
I love whiskey.
You know,
grew up in Georgia. Jack Daniels is big, you know, George Dickel, any of those. But yeah, I loved whiskey. I loved spirits, whiskey mostly. I started reading on how to get your license, how to make it, things like that, and had to make beer to make whiskey. So Mike Bristol was a good friend of mine, so I went and talked to him, and he was very encouraging, said, you know, if get your license, I'll try and help. I don't know how to make beer, but I know how to make beer. Excuse me, Mike.
But, he does. Actually, I can attest to that, actually. I can personally
very, very
I can,
good.
Yeah, attest to his ability to make beer. So that's.
But he goes, I don't know how to make whiskey. I said, that's all right. I'll figure it out. And so I started researching and reading all I could and doing all I could to learn how to make it. And decided to build my own still here in the Springs. So I had some copper, cut out the plates. They were actually photogravure plates, which is a plate that you etch a photograph into, ink it, run it through a press, and you get an inked photograph. So I had those that were my own images. I built my still out of those, free copper, you know.
Yeah.
Couldn't use it anymore. And it made a 45-gallon still. I live in Colorado. I set out to make a Western whiskey. Like a whiskey when you know, in a Western movie, somebody walks up to the bar and puts their hand down on the table and give me a whiskey. And that's what I set out. And so my labels have that feeling. It has a tapered cork in it. It has a cage, a champagne cage that I twist down to hold the cork in. But what distilling, as a photographer, I went out, took photographs to get my art out is the best way to say it.
Right.
So distilling is that now where I daily do something. Either I'm distilling or mashing in or labeling, but I'm meticulous about what I'm doing, and it's the process of getting my art out. So putting the labels on the bottle is part of my art. Distilling is part of it as well. Even going out and selling it and delivering it, you know, yeah. It's a part of that. It's just really nice because it's something that I can make that a lot of people can enjoy. Where photography, my pictures were a little more precious and shouldn't have been, but they seem to be that way. And this, I really can make a lot and get it to a lot of people to enjoy it.
It's interesting how today so many things are disposable or seem disposable. And whiskey offers a particular kind of culinary experience in that, you know, going from the shape of the bottle, the look of the bottle, the cork, as you were talking about, and the whole gestalt of the experience.
Right. And, yeah, I wanted to create an experience when someone saw the bottle, tasted the whiskey, wanted it to put them back into that Western movie, you know. So that's what I think about daily as I'm distilling and bottling and labeling, and how can it get better? How can it be experienced more?
You know, you have when it comes to whiskey, and I imagine a lot of other things, you have a cultivated palate. And I wonder about that. I wonder about learning how to taste what you're supposed to be tasting for. I know in literature, I sometimes think as an English professor, part of what I'm doing is educating the imagination of one's students. And I wonder, how would you do that in terms of whiskey? How would you educate the whiskey imagination of the off-topic listenership?
Reading a lot. There's the Whiskey Bible by Jim Murray.
Yeah.
He's an English guy that tastes over 4,500 whiskeys a year.
Wow.
And compiles the Whiskey Bible together with all these, and he has great tasting notes.
Are you in the Whiskey Bible?
I am. I'm in the 2013, which was tasted last year. The highest he'll give a whiskey is 97.5 points, and that wins Whiskey of the World.
Wow.
From 94 to 97.5 points, he awards you liquid gold status. And my barrel number 2 of my Aspen Stave finished whiskey got 94 points.
Has it changed? Has that changed things for you? Has it changed things for your operation now that you've got this really global, now that you've made it into the Bible?
No, I don't change for me, no. It validated that I was on the right track.
Are you like some kind of freak of nature, or are you, or does that, like, I mean, does that have to do with how cultivated your palate is to begin with? I mean, if you had to attribute, how would you explain it?
Yeah, yes. I think I've told people that if I was 23, 25 out of college,
yeah,
I would not be making the whiskey that I'm making today. Definitely life experience, palate, being a photographer. I understand a lot more than I ever did as being that young. So all that goes into making my whiskey. I wouldn't have the photogravure plates that I built the still out of.
Sure, yeah.
They're a lot, you know, and the knowledge. Just, I don't know, something that...
It's interesting the way in which those plates and the still, they have a kind of, even though the movement, like you really switched careers, there's a continuity
yeah.
that the substance provides.
Yeah, and that's where 291 comes from, as well as it's photo-based. Alfred Stieglitz, turn-of-the-century pioneer photographer,
sure.
Had the very first gallery ever, and it was Gallery 291 in New York. That was my dorm room number at Savannah College of Art Design, studying photography. So with the photogravure plate, the process reminds me of the darkroom The distilling process reminds me of the darkroom quite a bit. So that's where 291 comes from. And so, yeah, I would not be making this whiskey if I was 24 years old. But being older and having so many life experiences has helped, I believe.
I wonder how your whiskey will be different 20 years from now.
Better.
absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you.
That was Michael Myers, owner of 291 Distillery right here in Colorado Springs.
So, Steve, you know, it seems like doing something like distilling your own whiskey, that takes some craftsmanship. You need to kind of know what you're doing to make it good, right?
Well, to do it legally, right? You need a certain amount of certification in order not to be put in jail. Something that you don't necessarily think that you need any kind of expertise with, and you think, well, what can go wrong? Is home renovation.
You know, I was looking at my couch shortly after I got a dog, and I was thinking, I can recover that couch. You know, how hard could it be?
How hard was it?
It was only when I had the couch on top of me and only a staple gun to fend it off that it turned out harder than
it looks. This was a bad idea. The thing is that we have this idea, I think, and it's an idea that comes from watching home improvement shows. It not only do you think, I can do it, you think, I should do it.
Martha's doing it.
Why am I not doing it? It's the kind of thing that happens more often than not. Just because we can do a thing doesn't mean we should do a thing. That was one of the things that Michelle Blessing, ERA Shields Realtor here in Colorado Springs, that was one of the points that she made when I asked her about do-it-yourself wrong turns that she's encountered during her career as a realtor.
I'm Michelle Blessing. I work with ERA Shields Real Estate, sell houses, and been a resident in Colorado Springs for probably 25, 30 years.
All right. So this is an episode on do-it-yourself. And I wonder, as a real estate agent, have you encountered instances wherein people should not have done it themselves?
Probably on a daily basis, I encounter that.
Like what kind of things?
You see a lot of paint, faux painting, all the time. And
does faux paint mean, what does that mean?
It means like when somebody tries to make their wall look like it's something other than just paint. So maybe look like concrete or use a rag to kind of give it some texture.
Okay.
When you watch the do-it-yourself shows, it looks easy. And so I think people think, oh, I can do that. And they go to the home improvement store, buy all the tools and make a mess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not a handy person. I'm not a do-it-yourselfer. Mm-hmm. And yet when I watch those shows, I find myself thinking, maybe I should give it a shot.
Yeah, therein lies the problem. So does everybody else. And I think there's something to that. I think everybody is creative deep down. You know, you want to create something and you want to be that's why we do crafts in school and why kids love that. And I think as adults, it's kind of this new way to kind of do crafts. And and then they go for it on their house.
Let's talk about the two or three worst do-it-yourself projects that you've encountered in your time. What I'm talking about is you've come into a house and you see something that someone has done themselves and you think, oh, no.
One that really stands out would be down in the old North End here in a beautiful old big mansion, and somebody put in a kitchen that would probably be worthy of a home in about the 200,000 range. And this is a house, you know, probably if in perfect condition be 2 million. And that's just bad. And not only was it a cheap kitchen, but you could tell that they had done it themselves. And so even though they had probably spent, you know, $10,000-$20,000 putting in this new kitchen, you know, it just needed to be torn out. So that was a really bad one. And then just the when people tile their floor, see that a lot.
Tile their floor?
Oh yeah, that's something a lot of people think they can do, and most people cannot. It's hard unless you practice a lot. But yeah, no tile, bad tile. You know, doesn't match up. It's, you know, the grout's uneven. Even the grout color is not good. It's takes a lot of practice. Like I said, you watch those shows and they make it look easy, but what you don't remember is this is somebody that lays a lot of tile. And so, yeah, they're good at it. And so,
It's interesting, those shows. I mean, do you watch – would your life be easier if those shows were off the air?
Yeah, absolutely. yeah, because I think it gives people a false sense of how it really works. I mean, sometimes it's realistic. You know, it's fun for me to watch as pure entertainment. But for the most part, I believe they take the most interesting, weird, crazy times and broadcast those. And it's just really not like that.
Meaning that it's a lot more boring than that?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, going and looking at houses, I don't know. I mean, you look at a lot of dogs usually before you find that perfect house. And yeah, I think, you know, and then again, you know, when I go to list a house, you know, talk to somebody who has a house for sale and they've done some of this really bad stuff and they're proud of it and they don't see how bad it really looks. Again, it's a difficult conversation.
That was Michelle Blessing. She's a realtor with ERA Shields here in Colorado Springs.
So, you know, Steve, one of the things that's interesting is that people may want to do these things. They still have that amateur spirit, but they don't have the capability to do it. We don't live in a world anymore where people get those skills growing up playing with the tools in the garage and building stuff and hammering nails.
Absolutely. The desire to do something yourself doesn't go away. What goes away is the culture that allows us to experiment and to fail.
We're much more cautious, especially with issues of children and play, than we used to be. I talked to Amy Fusselman, author of the forthcoming book, Savage Park, about these issues of children, risk, and play. So let's talk about Savage Park a little bit. How did this idea – well, first tell us what Savage Park is. What is Savage Park?
Savage Park is a book of mine that's coming out next year that's based on an adventure playground that my family and I visited in Japan named Hanagi Play Park. Hanagi Play Park is an adventure playground, which means that it is modeled after this type of playground that was begun – that was in during World War II in Copenhagen when that town was under German occupation. It was created by a landscaped architect named Thorensen.
And tell us about – how are these playgrounds different from a regular playground like I have across the street from my house in the park?
Well, the playgrounds are most different in particular because there's nothing – there's no play equipment per se in them. The equipment is generally donated scraps and or tools, hand tools, you know, that you would find in any grown-up's toolbox, hammers, Yankee drills as we call them, hacksaws, maybe hole punches, and
So hacksaws seems like not a good toy to give children to play with at the park.
Well, they're not, right? This is true in many respects. But the thing that's different about these playgrounds is, or in this particular playground, this type of playground, is that the whole notion of sort of letting your child go to act freely within a space that's already been sort of supervised and made safe is not the point. The point is that your child will be in the space with a tool that they may or may not know how to handle well, but they would be supervised in the handling of that tool with an adult, a play park supervisor, or perhaps you're a parent or another grown up. And that the idea would be that they would, that we wouldn't, you know, the goal is not to completely avoid mistakes. The goal is to learn what's possible in space with tools, with other things. You know, often these kinds of playgrounds have just donated scraps of all kinds of cast off materials, plywood, stuff that has, you know, splinters sticking out of it, nails, things that you can make stuff out of, things that aren't necessarily, you know, quote, safe.
So are kids really, are they just putting their eyes out all the time?
No, I mean, certainly not in Japan, in Hanagi Play Park. No, they're not. I mean, part of that is because of just the culture. I think that children are exposed to more, quote, I don't want to say dangerous, but let's say less surveyed, less safe-made spaces than in our country where childproofing happens before the baby is born. It's kind of a process, too, of, you know, not having the same thinking around objects that are, you know, there isn't so much of just objects that are for purely for children and purely for adults. There's a little more crossover in that, well, we can let the child experiment with X or Y. I mean, I think here in our country, it's a little more that it's bad parenting to let a child experiment, because part of what we decree as good parenting is, you know, that we keep our children safe from harm, safe from objects that might, you know, they might hurt themselves with. It's really about our comfort level with risk, which in our country, I think I can just make a sweeping generalization is hard for American parents.
That was Amy Fusselman, author of Savage Park.
This is Off Topic. It's the do-it-yourself episode. We're talking about different conceptions of do-it-yourself, different do-it-yourselfers.
Right. And how you, one of the things we're interested in is how you make the transition from doing it yourself for yourself, reupholstering your own couch in your own house, to maybe being part of something larger, a bigger vision.
Of not just having a couch and not just a newly upholstered couch, but a newly upholstered couch that goes into space.
We talked to Piers Bozzoni, author of How to Build Your Own Spaceship, about being part of a larger vision, a larger community of doing it yourself.
Normally, if you have a technological innovation of any kind, the general public gets to share in it pretty quickly afterwards. Mercedes-Benz patented the first motor car in, what was it, the 1880s, 1890s? 40 years later, the roads were clogged with them and lots of people had them. The Wright brothers flew their first airplane in 1905. Again, 40 years later, mass air transport was getting underway, and people could even own their own private airplanes. So the weird thing is we went to the moon, and that was, what, more than 40 years ago now. But somehow that experience hasn't really affected individual private lives. And so people are kind of suspicious. They're saying, where's the space age for us?
Right. So I remember, speaking of things like the Wright brothers and the airplanes, it is certainly, I know people who've done things who've, for example, my father's cousin built his own car from scratch. But the idea of actually building your own spaceship, one of the things that immediately seems to put a stop to that would be something like cash.
Well, NASA is used to building spaceships that cost many, many billions of dollars, perhaps even thousands, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. A new breed of entrepreneur who is putting their own money on the table in a lot of cases, they are building spaceships for a few billion dollars. And what they're doing in many cases is they're saying, well, they're starting off with small experiments to prove that they're not complete losers and nutters. They're starting off with a good track record in other businesses like Amazon or Virgin. And then they're saying, well, look, if you think we've got a good chance here, put a little money forward, buy a ticket. So they've actually pre-sold quite a lot of tickets, either for people or for payloads. And so they've been doing things step by step, incrementally. And all they've asked the government to do is either get out of the way or sign up as a customer. They haven't asked the government to pay for the building of their spaceships. They've just said to the government, look, if we can show this thing works, you become one of our customers.
Right. And so people like Elon Musk, who have more money than I do, nevertheless are putting their own money forward and doing on a larger scale what my father's cousin did, building his own car.
Yeah. When they went to the moon, when NASA went to the moon, which still, of course, ranks as one of the greatest triumphs of human ingenuity ever, Wernher von Braun, a German engineer who was largely responsible for the Saturn rocket, he said, well, sure, we can go to the moon in 10 years, but the paperwork's going to take us longer. And because, of course, any government organization, somebody says, right, we know exactly the right company to make the microchip for the computer here or the nose cone for that there. And then because it's a publicly financed contract, they have to go out and get all the other nose cone manufacturers and all the other microchip manufacturers to put in competitive bids and this, that, and the other. Private company doesn't have that kind of problem. A private company can just say, we think these guys should build the wings, those guys should build the seats, and they can just go blam, 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 get on with what they know is going to work.
One of the things that struck me reading your book is how many people are involved in this, that rather than having this monolithic, rather difficult to get to government agency that's in charge of everything and you can't really figure out a way into it, it seems like the personal spaceflight, the sort of do-it-yourself spaceflight, really draws on – people can be involved at all sorts of levels. You talk about the need to design a better seat, for example.
That's right. The need also to fulfill the expectations of the private people who go and climb into these things. Because these private people have seen 2001 A Space Odyssey, and that's what they want their experience to be like. So you have product designers, and for the first time, industrial designers working on the aspects of the spaceflight experience. NASA's never used industrial designers. It's only used engineers. And that's why their spaceships kind of look clunky, because the engineer says, well, you put a bolt through this, and then that'll hold that together. That's not really enough for people who want the exotic, slick, smooth design of what they think a spaceship should be like. So there are going to be caterers, you know. Somebody's got to make the space food for the people to enjoy as they do the two-hour haul to the top of the atmosphere before they have their actual rocket experience. Then there are the people who have to build the nice new lounges and lobbies and waiting areas and car parks down on the ground. And all of this will not be government money. This will be a growth opportunity for jobs in the private sector. So it'll feed a lot of mouths.
So how is the concept of DIY, do-it-yourself, different when we're talking about wealthy people putting $1 billion on the line as opposed to me deciding to recover my couch myself with duct tape and a staple gun?
I think the really interesting thing about all of the entrepreneurs who are now involved in spaceflight is that even if their money has come from other sources, they've always intended one day to get into space. So, for instance, the internet companies that they've started or the airlines that they've started, they're part of a vision for, I suppose, human expansion, human progress. They're visionaries. They're visionaries in the sense that they believe that what they're doing is going to be good and exciting for the world as a whole and not just for themselves. What this means, I suppose, in the DIY sense, is you can start a company selling widgets, and that's great, but you might have some broader vision for where you want to go, so you just step-by-step see that through. The DIY aspect, it's different when you have a lot of money. It's not DIY in the sense that anyone can go and build these things in their sheds. But you look at the scaled composites company, for instance, that built the Virgin Galactic hardware that is about to fly into suborbital space. Bert Rutan, the designer there, loved gliders and sailplanes when he was a kid. He set up a little company making these out of carbon composites, which is a new material to make airplanes out of at that time. Step by step, he built up the company. But there was never one moment when he didn't think that space was the logical endpoint for this. You just sort of move forward and move forward, try and do bigger and better and more exciting things with each thing that you do. And I suppose that's the do-it-yourself thing.
That was Piers Bozzoni, author of How to Build Your Own Spaceship.
This is Off Topic. It's the do-it-yourself episode. Stay with us. Thank you.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. It's the do-it-yourself episode. We're talking to different do-it-yourselfers and about different conceptions of what it means to do it yourself.
So it's clear that when we think about things like going into space, doing it yourself, that there's that original vision, but there are a lot of players that have to come into the game in order to do it yourself.
So then the self-made, the idea of self-made, is that a myth?
Well, we talked to Mike Lapham, who's the co-author with Brian Miller of Self-Made Myth, The Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed. What he and his co-author did was really look at a lot of stories of these self-made men to see exactly how much of that self-madeness is really dependent on government help.
We want to believe in this country that, you know, the work of one individual is responsible for all our success. And, you know, there's a lot of ramifications if we believe that. You know, if you believe that, then you're likely to believe that, you know, government just gets in the way and we should, you know, keep that person's taxes as low as possible. You're likely to believe that if someone is not wealthy and not successful, that it's because they didn't work hard or, you know, try hard or some failing of theirs. You're likely to believe that, you know, fair wages are just stealing from those, you know, successful, wealthy people. Social safety nets are, you know, promote laziness. A whole bunch of things that you, if you believe that all the success comes from that one individual on his own with no outside help, you're going to believe all those things. And we have a very different view in our book, and we profile a number of entrepreneurs who recognize that their success really comes from a lot of sources, you know, luck and head starts and the contributions of lots of other people, but especially the investment of government that makes their success possible in many, many ways. And once you start to see it that way, the sort of built together, the reality that we do all this stuff together, there's a whole other set of, you know, consequences that flow from that.
So what are these? What are the resources? These things that we sort that we seem a little bit blind to, that we take for granted, that make it possible for people to have this seemingly pull themselves up by their bootstraps, make it themselves, great luck of being self-made people.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, in the self-made myth, we profile these people, many of whom, you know, on the face seem to be self-made people, you know, and probably many of them have been described as self-made. You know, I think of Martin Rothenberg is one of my favorites in there. And he was born in Brooklyn. His dad was a house painter. They weren't really poor, but they were sort of working class. And he went to the public library and had an interest in electronics. And so he took out every book that he could from the public library and learned about electronics. He went into the Army. He came out, you know, on the GI Bill. He went to college. He went to graduate school on public grants. And he credits, you know, not only all that public investment in him, and he ended up studying linguistics and putting that together and creating this company that that called Syracuse Language Systems, which developed you know, tools for people to using technology to who had language issues. But he also, you know, totally credits his employees. You know, he said, you know, his company wouldn't be possible at all without these publicly educated employees who had all the skills that he needed, including financial skills, that he could surround himself with and build a company.
Right. But that still sounds like a really Horatio Alger story when you think of this guy in the public library putting himself out there, taking out all of those books and reading all of those books. You know, the library's there for everyone. Not everyone takes advantage of that.
Right. Yeah, there's no question. You know, we totally recognize that it does take hard work, and some people have good ideas and inspiration and the focus and dedication. You know, we don't take that away at all. But what distinguishes all the people in this book is that they recognize that it's having this fertile ground that is created by the government, government investment in public education, in publicly funded research, in, you know, the infrastructure and the transportation that make it possible to do this work, the regulations. You know, a lot of people complain about regulations, but regulations make it possible for all these business people to do their work. You know, the courts and the laws that they rely on to pursue, you know, to be able to sign contracts.
Right. So in your book, you look at some of the people who tout their own self-madeness, people like Donald Trump, who really says, you know, I built this myself, it's me, and break that apart and say, not so fast, buddy.
Yeah, you know, there's a number of people in the book who sort of were born on third base and thought they hit a triple. you know, we talk about the Koch brothers who, you know, have right. benefited a whole lot from public subsidies, land subsidies and farming subsidies and so forth, and yet are totally engaged in undercutting many of the good things that government provides. We look at Ross Perot, who made a fortune because he figured out a way to do Medicare contracts, you know, and he did it over and over. He sold it to one state and another state and another state, and he made, you know, millions and millions of dollars doing that. And totally, you know, so on the one hand, he's benefited from public investment and public programs, and on the other hand, he's, you know, trashing government and trying to minimize government. So there's several people in the book that we point to who sort of do well, and then they want to pull up the ladder behind them.
That was Mike Lapham, co-author of Self-Made Myth, The Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed.
This is Off Topic, and I'm Steve Hayward. It was midnight on the Saturday of the Labor Day weekend when the dead skunk appeared on the road in front of our house. I had just flown into Denver from Des Moines, and when I pulled up to the house, I saw the skunk in the middle of the street. Well, not quite the exact middle of the street. It was on my side of the street and in front of my house. The smell was awful, and it was everywhere. "What is that?" said my wife when I came in the door. "Can you smell it?" "Of course I can smell it," I said, and I told her about the dead skunk. "It's everywhere," said my daughter. "It's like someone dipped the whole house into skunk. It's in my hair. I have hair that smells like skunk." "I'll do something about it in the morning," I told them, though I was certain I wouldn't have to. Something else would take care of it for me. Maybe a bear or a mountain lion, maybe a coyote or a buzzard. Maybe the city would come by and clean it up. There were plenty of reasons to hold out hope. "The city isn't coming," pointed out my wife in the morning, when the skunk and the smell were still there. "It's Labor Day weekend." I decided to call Professor Wright in the religion department. Not only did Professor Wright graduate from graduate school, he also graduated from law school. He's a sort of professor who lives for ethical dilemmas. I told him about the skunk. "Well," I asked him, "is this my problem?" "Are you thy skunk's keeper, in other words," he said. "It's not my skunk," I reminded him, "and this is hypothetical." "Of course," he said, and then there was a long silence. I wondered what he was doing, if maybe he was looking it up, if there was perhaps specific verses in Leviticus that dealt with such a question. "I'm afraid," he said, "this has fallen to you. You have to do it yourself." Do it myself? What did that mean? Did I have to bury it? Would I have to incinerate it? Would there need to be a funeral? What would I wear? I hung up the phone, and confusion descended upon me. But then I had what can only be called a moment of clarity, and knew what I had to do was get the skunk somehow into a garbage bag. Then I'd carry it to the park and leave it there, on city property. On Monday then, or whenever, the city would take it away. What they did with it afterwards was up to them. They were the city, after all. They must deal with dead skunks all the time. They would know what to do. My sons followed me out to where the skunk lay. It was the first time I'd got a good look at it. I'd assumed it had been run over, hit by a car. But now, looking at it up close, I wasn't sure. It lay there on the concrete, serene and strangely unbloodied, its tiny clawed hands uncurled and at peace. On its face was an expression that made me think it had died mid-sentence. And another thing it might have been saying just before being struck down, perhaps by a massive coronary, perhaps by lightning. Okay, I told my sons, get ready. Hold the garbage bag open. It was not, as it turned out, all that easy to get the skunk into the shovel. Every time I picked the skunk up, it seemed to leap out back onto the pavement. Maybe it's not completely dead, said Jimmy. I knew what I had to do. I went inside into the kitchen and brought out a pair of salad tongs. And then, as if the skunk was not a skunk at all, but a large, clawed, stinking tomato, I grasped it between the salad tongs and lifted it off the pavement, balancing it improbably, almost magically, over the garbage bag. Then I dropped it in. Now all I had to do was dump it at the park. That would be easy. The boys went inside to watch the end of the ball game, and I walked down the street with the garbage bag. I smiled to myself. I had done it. I had done the thing myself. Now, the fact of the matter is that there are good days and bad days to surreptitiously dump a dead skunk at a park. There are times when the park is empty and mostly silent. Those are times when you can open a trash can and squeeze a dead skunk inside and walk away entirely unnoticed. But this was not one of those days. This was a sun-drenched 76-degree day in September. This was Labor Day weekend. I had never seen so many people at the park all at once. They were everywhere. Whole families were crowded around barbecues, badminton rackets in their hands. Other families had volleyballs. Some were playing pickup basketball. Others were playing horseshoes. Still others were chomping on cobs of corn. A swim team was having some kind of celebration. Dogs frolicked. Lovers lolled on beach blankets and pushed grapes into each other's mouths. Someone had a transistor radio. People were dancing. 10 games of touch football appeared to be going on simultaneously. On the edge of the park, a kid apparently in the midst of a birthday party swatted at a piñata. It burst open and candy spilled out everywhere. After picking up the candy, the kids and their parents ran off to the playground equipment. I knew it was now or never. With my skunk-filled garbage bag in my hand, I sprinted up and opened up the garbage can next to the broken piñata. The skunk didn't fit, not at first anyway. I had to lean into it and could feel the face of the animal beneath the garbage bag, its soft eyes and teeth, its weirdly half-opened mouth. In the distance, I saw the parents of the kid who'd broken the piñata pointing at me, and I didn't know what would happen next. But then something gave, and the skunk fit inside, and then I was sprinting away. There were voices behind me, but I didn't stop. I had done it. The thing was out of my hands. It was their skunk now. If something had to be done, they would have to do it themselves.
Off Topic is produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell with help from the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, a part of Rocky Mountain PBS, in association with Colorado College and KRCC in Colorado Springs. And special thanks to our interns, Leeds Mallinckrodt Reese and Atticus Mormon.
For more information or to download any of our episodes, to download any part of this episode that you might have missed, you can find us at www.offtopicradio.org. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And until next week, stay off topic.